Okie doke, now we get the people on Zoom.
Good morning, everyone. So we'll be offering a short mandala and a repository view of Dhamma Tibetan. So if you could go to your gold prayer books on your desk on page 97.
If you want to, otherwise you can just relax and listen. But I'll explain in a second what we're going to do. Make it simple words. So what we're doing is this thing. It's a Tibetan thing, but it has meaning. Now, something doesn't have meaning until you don't do it, all right? Well, I'm trying to talk to the Zoomers first. Let me get them in board, on board. Are you all here? Okay, people, we're here, and we're about to offer a mandala, as they say. So what we're thinking, you can do the words if you want. We'll say it in English. No, we'll sing in Tibetan, but what you think, what the meaning of this is very simple. It's we're going to have some words here. I'll be coming out of my mouth, but they're coming from the Buddha, really. They're not, you better walk out the door right now. It's a fraud. So they're coming from the Buddha. So we're kind of just like, when you go somewhere, you don't go empty handed. You bring a bottle, you bring a dish, or you go for some, buy an ice cream, you give money. So we're offering, we imagine, use your creative imagination, imagine all the marvelous things of the world that makes everyone happy, all the objects of the senses, and pile them all up. And imagine offering to the Buddha as a request. For the teachings. That's the meaning. Don't say anything to me. And we do this little, like all these gangster gestures. the gangsters in Los Angeles would love it. I know, there were some gestures. Well, this is meant to replicate the universe. You'd never know it, but it is. Go on. Prayers are on the Zoomers, but the Zoomers, where is they don't have prayers. Well, next time we have new ones, you give them the prayers.
Okay.
All right. Mind. So as an auspicious kind of gesture for us to achieve that ourselves. Lovely meaning, Mary Rose. It's a bit foreign to us, but that's what it means. So okay, we started on the right track. And now another little prayer, moving us in the right direction. This one is the first two lines for anybody in the room who's already identified being Buddhist. We're reminding ourselves, we're reiterating our reliance on the Buddha, the Dharma, and his teeth, and the Sangha. You know. The second two lines are stating our purpose of being together, stating a really altruistic, kind of expansive goal, purpose for why we're together. The Tibetans say it's setting your motivation. So we're thinking, you know, we're going to listen, it means me as well, to these words as advice, to help us develop our own amazing potential, so we can help others, all the way to leading them to their own marvelous potential. That's the idea. So thinking like that. Sanghe charam sokhe chok namna jangshu badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chum yen ki pasanam ki drola penche sanghe drupashok sanghe charam sokhe chok namna jangshu badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chum yen ki pasanam ki drola penche sanghe drupashok Sanghe charam, sokhe chok namna, jangshu badu dagni kyab suchi, dagi chum yen ki pasanam ki, drola penche sanghe drupashok. So a bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. Compassion is the point, it's the action wing, it's like the political wing, it's for the people. You got to be useful. And how can you be useful if you still have a bit of a peanut and living your own misery and depressed and angry and jealous and resentful and get distressed and want to sleep all day, you can't help us fly. Sort of obvious. You know? So just the same way that if you want to help people who are all, you know, bad, you know, sick or, you know, not, you know, overweight and sick and bad because they've got bad nutrition, you can help, you can have wish to help them, you can be exhausted from that compassion, but you won't be able to lift a finger until you have the wisdom to know how. It's really obvious, you know. But somehow we get that when it comes to, if you see people not knowing how to build houses, you want to help them build houses, but you first have to learn to be an architect. You help people get sick, you have to learn to know how yourself. It's really clear. But when it comes to being happy, helping people be happy, help people not suffer. We don't think there are methods for that. So we just kind of jump in the deep end and do the best and half the time make a mess. Because we don't know ourselves the methods, the technology, the methodology of how to get happy and stop suffering. In fact, it sounds like a joke to say there's methodology for that, you know. Just buy more cakes and have better boyfriends. That's what we think. But Buddha's got another take on it. This take is different. His deal is, this person called Buddha, this nice person back in India 2,500 years ago, who came out of this amazing, incredibly ingenious system of extraordinary thinkers and scholars and meditators. Even before that, as Dalai Lama says, I always say this project, these amazing Indians more than 3,000 years ago, who once began the investigation into the nature of self, only now beginning to be aware of these incredible thinkers, this amazing system that existed back then. He came out of that. I remember hearing on the BBC some anthropologists talking about how they were investigating the Hindu civilization, and that one of the key things they found was there was no evidence of any weapons. Think of what that means. There's no anger. So if the system, as a culture where there's no anger, they've got some pretty good systems there. Wow, they know how to get happy. And that's the tradition he came out of that drove these genius Indian thinkers and scholars and saints and meditators. The knowledge about which we have zero in our culture, maybe now is perhaps suggesting perhaps these people, have other people besides white Europeans go back to Jesus and Galileo, know something, you know, something like that. So he came out of that system and he found from his own experience, he went as far as he could go, and the whole deal was to learn how to navigate the way the world is and how to navigate your own mind, and they had systems that you can learn to rid the mind of suffering and its causes, rid the mind of suffering, certain level of suffering. He went as far as he could go and discovered there was still further to go. He felt that. So he diverged in his own direction, specifically in relation to his own findings about the nature of self, how things exist. So one way of framing all of Buddhism is in terms of it being a method of how to get happy and stop suffering. That sounds pernicious. Another one is it's definitely a system of ethics. It's fundamental to all of it. And the other one, which sounds very abstract to us, is business and wisdom. It's a method of how to stop ignorance and get wisdom. Now, that sounds abstract. And what's that got to do with happiness, you think? You can be the best physicist on this planet. Genius, wisdom coming out your ears. But you still go home and beat up your husband and children because you've got no ethics. And you're up and down like a yo-yo and have nothing and don't know how to be happy. In other words, the wisdom we talk about has zero to do with happy. That's really fascinating. For Buddha, they're utterly inextricably linked. In fact, you could say the main thing that is a way of framing all of Buddha's teachings, all of Buddha's methodology, all of Buddha's worldview, all of Buddha's practice is exactly that the extent to which we suffer and cause others suffering, the extent to which we're not happy and therefore can't help others be happy, is the extent to which we're living in La La Land. And this is Buddha's real deal. This is his thing. But it's very surprising to us to think this way. We have to understand it. When we do understand it, we are on track. We understand Buddha. If we don't understand it, we can think it means Buddha's, you know, all about being a nice person and not killing. That's true. It's not the essence of it. All about, you know, saying mantras. It's true, but it's not the point. But the main thing, doing the water bowl, doing the prostrations, doing your mindfulness, walking slowly, watching your breath. These are all good techniques, but they're not the point. You become a Buddhist if you choose to. You become a Buddhist. You actually define yourself as a Buddhist when you start working on your mind, because that's his expertise. Lessening neuroses, which being delusions, we'll go to this, and then growing your wisdom and therefore growing your compassion. Because they're totally linked. That's really surprising initially to do that. If we don't understand it, then we don't get the Buddhist point. And that's why if you want to be Buddhist, you've got to squeeze your brain a little bit, as long as you said, and understand the techniques, understand the ideas, understand the philosophy, understand the viewpoints, understand his thinking. Not just watch your breath and walk slowly. Walking slowly, that'd be a failure. I wouldn't be a Buddhist. I'd be cancelled, thrown out. Dalai Lama as well. He saw so fast, you can't believe it. One of my friends is mixed Tibetan said, you can't understand. He just so fast, so sharp and fast. Yeah. So if people were working slowly and being mindful, walking slowly, you'd be a failure as well. Okay. So compassion is the point. Be of use to the world, because we live in this world. We're like one tiny little kind of cog in a big wheel, aren't we? And all the cogs work nicely, the wheel works nicely. We're one little piece. And this is why the world doesn't work nicely, because we're all these independent, separate little pieces that kind of think I'm existing on my own, I don't want that cog next to me, go away. Then no wonder everything collapses, because we don't understand interdependence. And this is the real view. All the teachings of Buddhism, all the language, all the stages of practice lead to the understanding of that one, which is the key of logics to prove the way things exist ultimately. It sounds kind of like, well, that's not my job. My job is just to live a life. What do you mean I've got to find out how things exist ultimately? It sounds so ridiculous. Well, if you want to get happy, you better do it. But it says there's a method all there. It starts small, start in junior school, one step at a time. So the way we are now, we'll talk about samsara and nirvana. Being in samsara is Buddha's way of talking. I don't know what it even means, the word, I don't know. But it means if you're in samsara, then you are caught up in suffering and the cause of suffering, and you're living in la la land and you don't know what's suffering. You don't know how to get rid of it because you're just creating more of it, thinking you're going to get happy. And then you're in nirvana when you quit that. And you've understood the way things exist, and now your mind is in touch with it, and now you're content and wise and happy and can be a better driver, so you can be useful cop in the wheel and help it all work properly. So one way of saying that these reasons we all suffer, this sounds so abstract, it's like science fiction, is that we're running around all these separate cells, running around like it's a new cop, all, you know, my drone is go away from me, you don't want to move to the next cop, so go away. We all run around, running my whole world's a mess, my awareness. But it is, oh, we have this overwhelming sense of being a separate me. Concrete, set in stone. Overwhelming. This is really extraordinary aspect to us. This is the key, this is the problem. When that's gone, you know, we move out of samsara. So the root problem, why we suffer and why we harm others, this is the key point Buddha's making. First of all, this is the key one. It's in our mind. We live in this world. All the bits of the wheel, all the other pieces of the world, all the other people in the world and events and things, all the bits and pieces, all the other cogs, they all play a role, no question. But we think they're the main problem. Buddha says that's the first big mistake, and this is the toughest one. He says your mind is the main problem. Your mind is the main player in your happiness and suffering. This takes time. Even if you've been practicing for 47 years, as soon as someone looks slightly crooked at you, we leap into the view that I'm horrible and we're back to all the misery again. Separate me, how dare, blah, blah, blah. It's a tough one. Even to get clear intellectually, but your mind is the main player in your happiness and suffering. It's enormously hard to get. This is the exact point of this thing. Remember Lama Zopa said one time, and it sounds almost too shocking to believe it's true. The vast majority of all humans on this planet have absolutely no idea that what goes on in their mind plays any role at all in their lives. Seems almost impossible. What's it mean? It means we are totally addicted to the belief that the outside world are the main cause of our suffering and happiness. And we spend all our attention there from the second we wake up until the second we go to sleep. All our attention naturally is pointed out there. So we think happiness is out there to be found, and we think suffering is out there to be avoided. It's very clear, I'm not thinking that. So totally think it that it seems puzzling that it's not true. That implies the deepest mistake. So we've got to start where we are. So if Buddhist view is the exact opposite, you know, everything in the mind, in our mind, in the workings of our own subjective cognitive process. So what goes on there is the main source of our happiness, suffering now, and the programming of that mind will produce the future suffering or happiness. Because everything we think and do and say counts. Everything we think and do and say is the process of producing this person here. So learning to even hear that theoretically is really difficult. Then to practice it is even more difficult. So if the mind is the main player, we don't know what he means by the mind, because it's quite in many ways fundamentally different. We, you know, I remember, as far as we're concerned, we discussed the brain, which is brilliant. The brain's amazing. The brain's incredible. But without insulting neuroscientists or medical professionals, what goes on in the physical body, the brain, the genes, the DNA, the chemicals, they're all existing. For me, it's like saying that it's from the Buddhist perspective, they're like the physical indicator of what's going on in the mind. That's what we have to become familiar with. That's where the workshop is. That's where the source of happiness is. That's where the source of suffering is. And therefore, the source of our ability to practice compassion and be a benefit to the universe. The Buddha's expertise is the mind. It's surprising to say that. We didn't ever hear that Buddha's a psychologist. Well, he didn't speak Greek, okay? He didn't use that word back then. We use Greek words as soon as we have something fancy or something neurotic, like neurotic, right there, neurotic, psychopathic, bipolar, schizophrenic, sociopath, narcissistic. We love Greek words. I don't know why. What's wrong with English? So they're fancy things, usually the negative ones. I don't know if goodness has Greek words. I don't know. The negative ones, definitely the unhappy ones have Greek words. Makes it more serious, I think. The Buddha used the word mind. He also used the word consciousness, and these are used synonymously. And he's not talking about the brain. He's talking about the cognitive process, the subjective cognitive process, second by second, of what we think and feel, you know, to the subtlest, the grossest, to the most subtle level, way more subtle than any of the modern psychological or neuroscientific methods posit. That's why it sounds religious, you know, it sounds like religion. We can't see it with a microscope as far as we're concerned, it doesn't exist. The Buddha's view is really quite subtle, quite fascinating. The mind goes to the subtle levels, and we have to access those eventually. To do the job of unpacking and unraveling and deconstructing the context of our mind, the workshop, getting to hear the thousands and thousands of conceptual stories in there, packed deep down, the evidence of which is in our daily life, our feelings and emotions, and the body shaking. That's just the gross, that's the tip of the iceberg, the evidence of what's in the mind deep down. So our job is to learn first to know theoretically and then through meditation and our experience seriously unpacking and unraveling and drilling down ever deeper until we can hear crystal clear. It's like that, all these conceptual stories and hearing nakedly how they're a load of rubbish and no basis in reality. And that's the curious point of the psychological model, you know. You've got your negative, your positive, and your neutral states of mind. There's no fourth category. Well, I call the neutral lot the mechanics. But the negative and positive, you think of those, you get the other one. We know the words. We don't use Greek words, we use English words, or maybe they're coming from the Greek, whatever. We'll go back, you know. So we know we've got the first lot, the unhappy ones. You know, these are the voices of ego, the voices of the separate me, the voices of the panic-stricken, fear-based separate me. Attachment is emotional hunger that drives everything, as far as the Four Noble Truths are concerned, in the Buddha's first teaching, which are the Hinayana component of the path, the practices, the teachings we share with the Hinayana path, the teachings you have in Burma and Thailand, the Buddha's first teachings, the so-called Four Noble Truths. He stated this, he stated what he found. One, there is suffering. Two, there are causes. Three, you can get rid of them. Four, how to do it. That was his first teaching. That's the wisdom wing. So according to that view, you can argue that attachment is the main, Mama Zopa says, the main cause of suffering. Now, if we want to understand Buddha, then we hear that, we'd better understand what it means, because it's not the analysis we have in the world. Quite different analysis. Totally different, but pretty different. To really know what he means. And this takes time. As long as she says, I can tell you about attachment for one whole year. We will never begin to understand it until we start kind of going deep inside and getting an experience of it, seeing the workings of it, and seeing how it breaks our hearts. And it's the source of all the other dramas. In Buddhist psychology, they always talk about, in the teachings, you always hear about 84,000 neurotic states in mind. That term I use, Buddhism use that obviously, but I like that term. 21, and then you got the three. We all hear about the three poisons, three, you know, these three toxic emotions. And these 78, these 84,000, as Ling Rinpoche says, and young Ling Rinpoche was here recently, wasn't a couple of years ago, somewhere a couple of years ago. As he points out, 21,000 illusions, the first one, ignorance, this assumption of a separate me, deeply ingrained. Then 21,000 illusion in attachment, the main voice of that assumption of me. And then the other 21,000 illusion in anger, which is the response when attachment is thwarted. And then the fourth 21,000 illusion in all three. So it's a really coherent map of these three. If we understood these three, ego grasping, attachment, aversion, these simple English words, we'd understand Buddhism deeply, and we'd understand ourselves. And we don't understand other people. This is so shocking. This is not how we think in the West. And that's okay. It's different. So we have those words in all of psychology, you know, ego, attachment, anger. We don't give them the same meaning as Buddha does. He's fundamentally different in many ways. So if you want to know what he means, you've got to learn to know his language, what he means. Let us put our own meaning into it. I mean, you do what you'd like. Buddha's our boss. He's not telling us what to do. If you want to understand what it means, you better go from this point. And you have to know what it's saying, then you can decide if not, if you like it, or you want to use it. So the main problem, which sounds hilarious, is we're a bunch of separate selves all running around, bumping into each other, harming and killing and stealing and lying, and then hungry for each other, and jumping on each other, and pushing each other away, all fighting and yelling and screaming, you know, all these separate selves. That's the final mistake. It seems so absurd. What would it be if you didn't have a separate self? It would be very confused, I think. This is when you've accomplished the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. You have this extraordinary, you would have rid yourself of all the rubbish, no longer any fear, no longer any neuroses, no longer any delusions, no longer any disturbing emotions, unhappiness, up and down like yo-yos, none of that, gone. Buddha has found that they are not at the core of our being and can be removed. So what's left? Love and kindness and wisdom and clarity, the bonus called happiness, joy, fulfillment, bliss, whatever word you like. So that was the very first way of saying it. The method to get happy is to give up delusions. And how to get wisdom, give up delusions. How to help others, give up delusions. This is the main job. And then grow the other parts of your mind. And that takes time. There's like a big emotional soup in there. We can't tell one from another if we don't look. If you wait for it to come to the level of the body, then you're inert one day in bed and you can't get up and you discover you're depressed. Well, it's a little bit late. Think on it for months and years and days, and now you finally see the symptom. You can't move. Or you vomit out the mouth and now you discover you're angry. It's a bit late. I mean, the stories have been underneath there for a long, long time. It explodes to the surface. A bit late. But 120 kilometers an hour on the freeways, it's a bit late to discover that your wheels are falling off. That's our tragedy in our culture. We don't pay attention until it's too late. No wonder we have mental breakdowns. No wonder we have all these enormous mental sufferings. So we don't pay attention to the mind where the source of them is. So we think it's the boyfriend and the girlfriend and the weather and the traffic and the politicians and the food. We keep working on them. Work sometimes, then it fails. So it's quite an interesting approach. So you want to help others, you've got to do this work first. Because while they're suffering at the same rate as you're suffering, no difference. We're all the same recipes, just different variations, different, same context, just different recipe, more anger, less this, more that, less that. The Buddha's view of the world very fascinatingly doesn't just belong to, doesn't just refer to humans. Buddha asserts a whole range of sentient beings, a whole range of mind possessors. It's a lovely word in Tibetan, a sentient being, mind possessor. There are trillions, upon countless trillions, of mind possessors. Humans are a tiny percentage. So this model of the mind refers to all of them. Very fascinating. And explains why we're in these different realms of existence, and explains why we have suffering, and explains how to get rid of suffering, and explains how to get happy. That's what Buddhism is, a methodology. He's not a creator. This scientist in Nelson one time said, it happened to be a scientist, he asked a question, which is amazing. I've never heard this question before. Since then, it's a brilliant question. He said, who revealed the teaching to the Buddha? Because that's the assumption of religion, isn't it? There's revelation from on high. And I said, well, who revealed the teachings about relativity to Einstein? Of course, everyone laughed. Well, Buddha's more like Einstein. I'm not joking. He used his noggin, used his mind, observed the universe, particularly observed the workings of the minds of the beings of the universe, because this subtle awareness can develop, the likes of which we don't posit in the modern world. And then on the basis of his observation of the way the mind works and how it works and the universe itself, came up with his findings. And then did the job of himself of ridding his mind of all from all the rubbish and developing his perfect wisdom and perfect compassion, becoming a Buddha. And he says, everyone can become this. You don't need creating, you don't need a creator, you don't need a punisher, you don't need a rewarder, you don't need revelation. Use your own mind. Just like a botanist or an engineer or an architect or a musician. But genius is that. Knowing it all comes from the mind. And then you have a piano, then you play the music. But when it comes to happiness and suffering, we haven't got a clue. Buddha would suggest we're up the track without it. No, you can't be without a paddle up a track, can you? Mm-hmm. Up a track without a paddle, wrong one. Well, you're up a creek without a paddle, that's right. It has to be Australian, isn't it?
It has to be Australian.
What about the garden? What's that one?
The garden path.
What?
Up the garden path.
Up the garden path, that's right. Maybe that sounds like Pommy. So anyway, so we want people to be happy. We want to have these amazing aspirations in the four immeasurable thoughts. So just say them. And we'll kind of unpack. So this particular thought is so forth, four immeasurables. Four immeasurable thoughts, four immeasurable wishes, four immeasurable aspirations. This is not just for oneself. This is now for others to have them. But oneself clearly has to have them first. So that it is how wonderful it would be if all mind possessors, all sentient beings, could have happiness. No, could be free. No, could have equanimity, particular kind of equanimity, such that we recognize friend, enemy, stranger, but equal in their wish to be happy in ourselves. So how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had this equanimity, free of attachment, aversion, and indifference. That's the essence of the first thought. Then you pat it out and you say, may they have them. Then you say this brave attitude, this expresses a brave attitude of these outrageous bodhisattvas, these amazing beings who have this brave attitude, this sense of responsibility. As if every being on the planet is your precious child and you know it's your job to help them get happy and stop suffering. I will make this happen, the next thought. The brave attitude, I will make this happen. Then, please bless me to be able to do this. The next second one, how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings could have happiness. And Lama Zopa adds there, but enlightenment. And he doesn't want us to have all be happiness. It's okay. and its causes. May they have them. I will make this happen. Please bless me to be able to do this. Talk to the Buddha that way. Give me some inspiration from him. How wonderful it would be all sentient beings could be free of suffering and its cause. And that's it. Oh, well, the second one is suffering, the third is happiness. And it's caused the same thing. And then fourth, how wonderful it would be all sentient beings were never parted from higher rebirths, which of course implies Buddha's view of continuity of consciousness. And liberation is excellent bliss. Well, liberation is nirvana. When you quit samsara, you're in nirvana, and the bonus is you're blissful. We'll discuss this. It's kind of a fascinating point. May they have them. May they never be parted. I will make this happen. Please bless me to be able to do this. So this is the brave attitude of the Bodhisattvas. This outrageous, confident, marvelous, wise, delusionless, dumb the wisdom weaning. Amazing beings, you know, who have this sense of responsibility, sense of enthusiasm to want to never give up, benefiting others. It's like basically a saint. But we don't have courses to get. Can we go to university and then be a saint? We can't, can we? There's no courses like we could be figured you're kind of born that way, you know. No, Buddha says everybody can become like this. That's it. Anyway, so yeah. So okay, this is our framework for this discussion. So, hear the words. May that be free of suffering. So then the thought, may they be free of suffering, that's immediate compassion. May they have happiness. That thought, may you have happiness, that's love. They're the definitions of love and compassion in Buddhism. May you be happy, may you not suffer. That's love. They're expressing compassion, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable love. That's the meaning of love and compassion. And they're the essence of all the positive qualities. I think we know that. Delighted in the happiness of others and wanting to be happy. But the wisdom wing gives you the method of knowing how. You've learned your nutrition. Now you know how to help people. It's mega nutrition we're discussing here. But now you know how to help. This is actually a tremendous point. You know, right now, when we see all the suffering in the world, wars and dramas and epidemics and people dying and children raped and murdered and animals cut to pieces, and we go absolutely, we have compassion. But the reason we suffer so unbearably, one, we have no idea why it's happening. We don't have, in our modern, you know, the philosophical materialist view of the universe, which is a valid view held by millions of people, nothing wrong. It's a view of the universe. There are no explanations for most of these things. 47 talks about why Hitler. We can't come up with a reason. Because we're only looking, this is the Buddhist view, we're only looking at the physical. Now, the Christians would say the same. You can't get the answer by just looking at the physical. They've got another take on it. And it's all about the creator. So that's another view. Now, I'm sure the Australian Aboriginals have an amazing view. I don't know what it is. I haven't studied it. And Buddha's got another view. I think seen over the centuries, all these amazing humans, you've got to have such respect, you know. Who do we think we are criticizing? And looking into the meaning of life and come up with their own viewpoints. Sure, maybe some are wacky. Like old Mr. Stalin, deluded as hell, right? His view of the world was nuts. But there are these views, people trying to find the meaning of life. How amazing. It always interested me. I'm not trying to sound so holy. I joke with my sisters because one of my sisters, Julie, has never had the slightest interest in why. But she's a happy, perky person, runs around helping the world. But her husband said there would never be disharmony in our family because Julie wouldn't allow it. But she's kind to everyone. She knows everybody's birthdays. We've got 27 grandchildren from one daughter, sister, and 7 great grandchildren. Julie knows every name, every birthday. She makes sure everybody sees. I mean, she's a control freak, but a lovely, kind one. But she has no interest in whether it's God or heaven or karma, what happens when you die. She has never had those questions even once. So we're all different, right? It's always what I thought about. I'm not trying to sound so special. I'm more neurotic than Julie, probably. All different, isn't it? But it fascinates me. But over the centuries, as long as humans have half a brain, we try to work out the meaning of life. And many of us think these questions. We should probably go to places where you can learn about the meaning of life, such as a Buddhist center or a university where you learn science. Same thing. It drives, they're driven by the same wish. Isn't it? So here we're dealing with Buddhas. In particular, the Buddha's teachings from Tibet, which has these three levels of worship. If you go to Burma and Thailand, you'll learn the wisdom wing, the teachings we share with the wisdom wing. If you go to Japan and Taiwan, you'll learn the sutra component of the compassion wing, bodhicitta. If you go to Tibet, you'll learn the Vajrayana, like junior school, high school, university, and postgraduate. And they're all in the big lump in the Tibetan one. This is the tradition that's all from here. And this is coming from tracking it back to all the great holy beings back through the centuries, the great thinkers and scholars and meditators and philosophers and all the rest. And the body of knowledge is massive. It's not just watching breath and crushing fingers. Explaining Buddha's view, explaining his findings about the universe. And indeed, he's saying, here's my thinking, this is the methods, and you can do it too. So the literature is coming from all the beings who've also done that job since that time. So this is what I'm saying. Buddha really is more like Einstein. It sounds absurd, like it's as if I'm being sarcastic, but it's not. It's exactly the same. So Dalai says to us often in our culture, if you decide you're going to follow Buddha's teachings, I'm using the word methodology. If you decide to, it's fine. But then what you're going to do is practice it. But then as you go, you tick the boxes, don't you? Let's say you're heading to E equals MC squared in physics in a few years' time. You have to learn first that 1 + 1 = 2. And you learn it, you experience it, you tick the box. Yep, Einstein's right about that. You go to the next one. Einstein's right about that. You go to the next one. Einstein's right about that. And you keep ticking the boxes as you go. You don't just memorize it solid whole. That's useless. You'd be an idiot. You don't just believe in botany. You don't just believe in E equals MC squared. We know that. We would laugh at that. Why believe in mathematics? We don't think that. But we say that religion, because that's the thing. We don't think you can prove it. You've got to believe in it. If you have a creator, he's right, who revealed the teachings, you have to have faith. You have to believe it. You can't prove it. If you can prove that God is right, then you become God, and you can't talk like that. Not in the creator religion. Buddha's not like that. So the Dalai Lama says, as you're ticking in the boxes as you go, it's my words, then if you get to a point where you prove he's wrong, well, of course you reject Buddha. Thanks, mate. Out of here. Enjoyed myself. That's what Buddha did. He diverged from the findings of the people he studied with. Isn't it? If you find that Buddha's wrong from your own experience, then of course you must reject him. Same with Einstein. Absolutely. That is a price of truth. That's the approach we need to take. We have to do the work. You can believe in math. Maths, they say math in America. You can believe in maths. There's enough people who know it, isn't it? But if your mother says, go buy me 5 oranges, you won't know how to do it because you can't count. So that's when you're lost. So the experience of all this that we're talking about is what causes you to lessen the suffering for your happiness. So let's go back to the following four things, always fours before immediate thoughts. So first one is be free of suffering. So if you want people to be free of suffering, you'd better know what suffering is, isn't it? And the next one, happiness. If you want them to have happiness, you better know what happiness is. Let's look at this. It's very, very, very fascinating. The first noble truth, teaching the Buddha first gave, stating these four facts about life, were the noble ones. The four facts that have been discovered by those who are called noble ones. So I think of very, if you've done the job, then you're a noble one. I don't know which term it is. And what's that word in Sanskrit? I don't know. What is it? What is it? You know, noble one? I don't know. Oh, is it? No, that's superior. Is it the same meaning as superior ones? Yeah. That's different. Well, arhat, is that noble? That's a noble one, isn't it? Oh. Okay, thank you. That makes sense. That's true. That makes sense. Thank you. That's exactly right. Foe destroyer. That's the foe destroyer. The enemy destroyer. When you destroy the enemy, the delusions, you're now a noble one. You're now an arhat. You're now a foe destroyer. Enemy destroyer. You've destroyed the enemy. This one. So now you're in nirvana and you're out of samsara. And this is the methodology. For facts that these noble ones have found to be true. Okay, so first one is there is suffering. And this is the big difference. This is the massive point that if we do want to understand Buddhism and how you can have love and compassion for everybody, that's the Mahayana one, then you have to know what it means, because it sounds demented to have love and compassion for everybody, because there's no logic. The Christian logic is because God made everybody and God is in everybody. That's a good reason. esophagus. So major vector understand what suffering means. So the first time was three times, and the first one's called the suffering of suffering, like in your face suffering. And essentially, it's when the bad things happen. Speaking very simply, we're not even discussing the bigger view here, which is the whole universe of many realms of existence. Forget that one. It's even within this human planet that we understand. The suffering of suffering is when the bad things happen. We utterly get that. Everybody in the universe knows that. You don't have to know the words for it. As soon as you hurt the dog a little bit, it goes away, because that's called suffering. He doesn't want it. As soon as you've been nice to the dog, the pussycat should help me. We know that. It's very part of the deal. So the first one already, let's look at that one. Look at the Buddha's analysis of that one. But the next one, in order to understand how all sentient beings are suffering, then we have to understand the next one as well, which is called the suffering of change. We'll go into that. But what I'm getting at in the general point is that we're all at, you know, these levels of suffering. So therefore, if you want them all to be free of suffering, which is the compassionate attitude, you have to know first what suffering is for yourself and what the causes are for yourself, and having done the job for yourself. That means you have to know your own mind. So Buddha's telling us in the second noble truth, there are two causes of suffering. Just two main ones, millions of causes, many conditions that have to come together. But there are two main ones. And the shockingest thing to hear is they're both inside me. You can just as easily say there are two main causes of happiness, and the main causes are inside me. This is the part that's totally confusing and really takes quite a while to understand, because it's utterly the opposite of what we all think. Utterly, completely, utterly, totally the reverse. So it's hard to hear it. Because mostly for us, we think there's one cause of suffering. When Eddie slurps his tea, Eddie's the cause of our suffering. Just that little baby moment of slurping. Or if Eddie punches me in the nose, Eddie's the main cause of my suffering. There's one cause as far as we're concerned. But in general, the cause we find is out there. It's out there. It's out there. Starting with mummy and daddy, going back to the monkeys, and then coming forward, all the people and things and events and occasions that have happened since you're born. They are where the causes of my suffering are, and they are also where the causes of my happiness are. So we learn, and that's what science is, and that's what our view is. We learn to become intimately, brilliantly, brilliantly, ingeniously familiar with the outside world. And Buddha said, of course it plays a role. No problems, people. Of course it does. A huge role. But it's not the main one. It's a catalyst. It's the best way to put it. Eddie's a catalyst for my suffering. And if Eddie's kind to me, he's a catalyst for my happiness. This is so shocking, it's hard to hear it. And this is why we have a struggle. We can't hear it properly. And don't just believe it. But it could be wrong. We have to prove it. The main cause of my suffering and happiness are what's going on in my mind. There are two main causes. The first one is called karma, the second is mind, and they subsume to the one. So forget even the first one. So if it's true that what goes on in my mind in response to Eddie's punch is the main cause of my suffering, and if what goes on in my mind in response to Eddie's kiss is the main cause of my happiness, if Buddha's right, then we need to look at what that means. You need to understand that intellectually first. Let's look. I think we can prove it immediately. If Eddie and I do karate, kung fu, the last one I did, kung fu, my kung fu teacher, Mr. Lee, taught me that if Eddie and I are sparring and he punches me in the nose, I apologize to him because I didn't get out of the way. You know, it's very interesting. You know, all these martial arts were started by the Chinese monks in the 8th century, I think. And they were these meditators, these holy beings, these bodhisattvas, who then develop these techniques to use the negative energy of the burglars and thieves with their big guns and rocks or whatever they had to divert, to stop them from harming for their sake. So Mr. Lee telling me to apologize to Eddie was me taking responsibility, so I didn't get out of the way in time. That's a wonderful idea, isn't it? But look, the simplest point is, when I got punched in the nose quite a few times, I broke a thing here, I've broken my glasses so many times, I had to have, you know, lasers. I didn't get upset. I didn't sue Mr. Lee. I didn't sue Eddie. Oh, I got punched today. I'm going to laugh. So right there, proving that my mind is the main thing. Now, if I got upset, how dare any touch me? That's why I'm suffering. Oh, I didn't mind being punched. That's why I was happy. I'm not doing my martial arts. I couldn't get back. Quick enough to punch anything. I mean, this is proving that the main cause of my happiness is in my mind. I didn't mind being punched. Now, I wasn't a masochist. Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
We're sort of saying, but that's different. No, it's not. It's how you interpret it. If I'm in love with Eddie, he just looks at me with his loving eyes. I faint with joy. Now you listen to this one. If I now hate Eddie, but he's still yearning for me, I can't stand the sight of his disgusting yearning looks at me. I want to vomit. Are we communicating? Are we really communicating? He's looking at me adoringly, but I find it repulsive now because I have anger in my mind. Before, when I had attachment, we were willing victims to each other, propping each other up in our attachment, then it was divine having Eddie look at me. So this is proving my mind is the main player. Same action, different response. Eddie and I are sitting at the red light. I'm shouting, yelling, and cursing. He's relaxing, wondering what happened to me, you know. He's seeing the red light too. He's not worried. So it proves these simple examples. What's in the mind determines whether you're happy or something. It's really pretty, but we're not happy with that. It feels too simplistic, like sneaking in and giving this simple answer, kind of wriggle. No, it can't be that way, we'll say. Now, this is the trouble with us, because we're so vindictive and we want to blame somebody. So it feels like it's getting Eddie off the hook. It's not. If he did punch me, that's not cool. He just created heavy karma. He's going to suffer as a result if he doesn't fix his mind up. That's not denied by my changing my view of Eddie. But we think it does. We think as soon as I think, oh, it's all my fault, oh, then it gets Eddie off the hook and keep punching me, that's completely absurd conclusion. What are you doing with the door open? Are we hot or something? We must be hot. Okay,
excuse me.
What?
The CO2 monitor. It's just too much.
Oh, is that what it is? Oh, how hilarious. That's what the bell was. That's hilarious. Who invented that Miffy body? She might?
Yeah.
I bet she did. I love it. CO2 monitor. She mentioned we'll be fainting from the carbon dioxide. That's hilarious.
Oh, I love it.
Okay, anyway. Are we communicating with people? So this is Dan Walsh, but this is the same thing. As Anna Zerba says, where is the abuse if you don't feel abused? That we can't cope with, but it's the same as the other one. Where is the kind action if I don't feel it's me, if I don't feel the kindness in here? So Eddie's action of looking at me lovingly and with a bunch of roses, it's coming from his kindness, is an aggravation of me. Because I've got anger in my mind, I don't feel any happiness. I mean, it's so obvious. We don't mind that much. But as soon as it's here, where's the abuse if you don't feel abuse? That sounds too shocking for our poor ears. We can't cope with that one. So there's two things going on. There's Eddie and there's me. And my job is to work on my mind. And then if I want to help Eddie or whatever, then I'll be qualified. So I understand what's going on. But we put all the blame onto Eddie for both my happiness and my suffering. And that, Buddha says, is a really mentally ill thing to do. It's attachment, and it's a symptom of a very unstable, unhappy, demented person. He says, join the universe, babes, because we're all mentally ill, and it's called attachment. And then called anger when my attachment is thwarted. And then all the other 73,997 neurotic states of mind. It's a minefield. We know enough of that. And these simple examples prove. The red light one, even simple, the red light is the simplest, most innocuous example you would find. Right there is the proof of this point. Eddie's more happy and relaxed, he's patient, he accepts the red light, he knows he can't change it, so might as well be relaxed. I'm shouting, yelling, cursing the red light to him. So who's happy? Eddie. Who's suffering? Me. Why? Because I'm seeing the red light a certain way. We sort of can prove it. We've got so many other thoughts and backup ideas that sustain the view of blame and therefore anger and vindictiveness. It's hard to unpack it. It's hard to undo it. So we've got to do that type of analysis very carefully and cautiously. And the interesting point is, when you've given up attachment and anger and you've got more clarity and you have more responsibility, therefore you're more happy, that's the bonus, then you have more compassion. So then maybe Eddie's a maniac and he's coming at me with his fist. I know exactly what's going on. And I'll even be able to help him if I've got enough wisdom. So I won't be neurotic. I won't be having a panic attack. I could even duck. Mm-hmm. I'll also know where Eddie's coming from. I'll see, oh my God, there's anger. There's Eddie, crazy Eddie. There's anger. And you know that because your own anger, you know you're suffering, so you know he's suffering. Except that's the problem. This is the part that's hard to see. We can see it if we think of it carefully. Think yourself of anything you've ever done in your life up to now that's done any harm at all to somebody else, even mild. Any words you've said, actions you've done that have harmed others. Check your mind at the time. It was not love. It was not patience. It was not empathy. It was not compassion. It was not generosity. It was not forgiveness. It was upset. It was irritated. It was frustrated. It was angry. And that was because of attachment, not getting what it was. That's the analysis. So, and then when you start to look at your mind and the wisdom ring, you really drill down, you really look deep and you own all this, not guiltily, but with compassion for yourself. We say that in the West a lot. They don't say that in Buddhism, but we get the meaning. It's a kindness to yourself. You see, and this is all Buddha's telling us, that my anger and my depression and my anxiety and my jealousy and my ego grasping, these are the source of my suffering right this second. Forget the future. But our hearts should break for ourselves when we see mistakes in mind that are the source of our pain. So seeing this, owning them, knowing they're not set in stone, knowing they don't define me, not being guilty about them, knowing I can change, we're all a work in progress, that underpins our practice. Then I look at Eddie and I can see he's exactly the same. And that's the basis of compassion. That's not where we think in our world. We want to blame the other people. We're innocent victims. How dare you do this to me? I don't deserve it. How dare? And we want to be vindictive. We want to be vindictive. We want him to suffer. Like, you know, I see it in America in the prison system. It's really intense. It's based on vindictiveness. There's one guy I was talking in prison. I know him. I've been talking to him. I know a few people in prison. This one fellow in New York State, he's now 87 or something. He's the longest serving prisoner in New York State, some little town, when he was 24 or something, raped and killed a girl, a 14-year-old girl. And there's no death row in New York, so they put him in, he was in prison for life. But he had a chance to be paroled, like they do, they allow. And he's been up for parole since he's eligible for coming to 60-something. And every second year he goes up for his parole. He's been up for parole 27 times. He's been rejected every time. And every time it happens, people who remember this event do their little questionnaires, go around in the town, and always keep this evil man in prison. So I remember one on Facebook, I mentioned this man. So I helped him write his memoir. His wife, actually, write his memoir. Since he's been in prison, 60 years or something, he's impeccable. He's working on Buddhist. He's devoted. He teaches Buddhist classes. He's during the riot in the prison back in the 70s, it's famous in America, called the Attica riots. Incredible, incredible kind of monstrous thing that occurred in some prisons there. He was part of that. He was helping people. He's an incredible human being. But he did one bad action when he was 24, and since ever, he's evil. That's how we think in our world. That's anger, and it's vindictive, and it's bitter. We think it's good. There's no, so now he's got cancer, and he's just about dead. In a way, I'm glad he's getting all the medical care, it's all free, But he's got to suffer. You've got to suffer. We want people to suffer. How come we can't see that's so deadly? Because the interesting, fascinating point for the Buddhist view, this is the part we find very hard. That that vindictiveness, that anger, that rage, that despair, that jealousy, that resentment, that all that, who do you think it harms first? The person. And that is how schizophrenic we are. We say, I'm allowed to be angry. It is not my fault. I'm allowed to be jealous. We actually say that. We say that really meaningfully, sincerely, as a truth. Meaning we're so demented, we can't see the pain that's causing us. Because we're so convinced that Eddie's action, Eddie, like harmed me. He even injected anger into me. But we can't see that it's causing suffering. This is entry-level, practically Venus or Brain 1 level of the book's teachings about karma. We just can't see it. We think I'm allowed to be angry. This really shows how deeply ingrained these views are and how we are our own worst enemy, as my mother used to say. This is huge. Forget long-term karma. Forget it. We actually talk about it. So if you want to start having compassion for other people, not just the innocent victims of pussy, wussy, the doggy, woggy, and the 1.5 children who get raped by a naughty man, they're the only ones we have compassion for because they're innocent. But how can you have compassion for every living being in the universe? May all sentient beings be free of suffering. May they be free. I will make this happen. You'd better damn well know what suffering is and its causes from your own point of view. Then you're qualified because you realize everybody is in the same boat. Everybody has delusions. Everybody has bad things happen to them. Everybody has good things happen to them. Everybody has some virtues, one kind or another. You can't possibly have that level of compassion if you haven't got this for yourself. And most of us, we don't even have it for ourselves, yet we still hate ourselves. We love to hate ourselves. We love to turn all these things the Buddha says into knives that we twist into our hearts and think I'm evil. This is the tragedy. So anyway, maybe I'm raving on too much. What time is it? Already 11 o'clock. It may be time for questions. What time is tea break?
12 o'clock for lunch.
No tea break, so lunch break. Oh.
10 till 12, so 2 hours.
Okay, questions, people. Any questions? I've said quite a few things here. The essence of what I'm trying to say is, if you really want to get compassion for everybody, you've got to do this first. You can't just meet. You can't go there. You can't rush off and help everybody with bad nutrition if you don't have nutrition. It's very simple. So we're talking wisdom, mental nutrition. Okay, questions, please. Any kind of questions? Anything on Zoom?
Not yet.
And that's why we have to go one step at a time. So if Eddie's a monster, you aren't leaping down in compassion for him yet. Leave the damn man alone, chuck him out. Start having compassion for yourself first, sort yourself out. Then one day you'll have compassion for him. That's advanced. That's a big mistake, too. Yeah.
Just picking up on what you said at the end there, that we love to hate ourselves. I'm curious as to understand a little bit more why and what we can do about it.
No. This is practice. Exactly. It's a symptom of a disease called dissatisfaction. And dissatisfaction is a symptom of having practiced attachment for countless lives. So take this as our view for now, the big picture, okay? Okay, so therefore we have to understand attachment. So attachment, one of its key functions is it over-exaggerates the deliciousness of something. That's its bare bones function. It comes from it comes from dissatisfaction going forward. What happens is this: you've got a $50 note and you're convinced it's 500. And you've seen it so often this way, you believe so totally and utterly and completely that 50 is worth 500. So think about this. So then the attachment energy, once you see it's 500, you believe it's 500, then you expect it to give 500's worth. And you think about it, you anticipate it, you build it all up, you're excited, you go out and you spend it, you try to spend it, and what's going to happen? What will be the result? When you discover you only get $50 worth, what will be the result?
Disappointment.
That's called anger. And then tomorrow you forget and you do it again. And you do it again, and you've been doing it for countless lives. Always believing that chocolate cake will bring you happiness, thinking it's more than it is. Always believing that Eddie will give you happiness, thinking he's more delicious than he really is. So the build-up of that anticipation and then the disappointment and the slap in the face when you don't get it, that's what dissatisfaction is. It's a build-up of thwarted attachment over countless lifetimes. So of course you're dissatisfied. When you don't get what you want, you're dissatisfied. It builds it up, doesn't it? That's dissatisfaction, and that's a symptom of having practiced attachment. So we get born with it. So for this little girl, some people have it much worse than others. We can see that. Some people have just spacious and content and joyful, even as kids. That means they haven't had so much attachment, and they come with the result of having a more happy, satisfied life. So if there is dissatisfaction, first, the main one is I don't have enough. That's a very distressing state, isn't it? So that means you're always hankering after more. Convinced when you get it, you'll get happy. The same attack, the same problem happens. You get disappointed. Whatever way you turn, you get disappointed. And it keeps adding more dissatisfaction. So dissatisfaction then gets really serious. And I am not enough. So everyone looks in the mirror. I don't know a human being on this planet who is satisfied with the way their body looks. Every one of you in this room, you're not satisfied with your body. You see the floppy bits, you see the muscles, you know, your left hand testicles too big, and your right hand toe is the wrong shape. I mean, get my point, people. We're too embarrassed to admit it, but we know our bodies intimately, every hair, every creak, every wrinkle, every little bit. And if we had eyes on our belly, we'd be with our bum all the time, check it. We're never, ever, 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 ever satisfied with our body, and that's just our body. Are we communicating? That's also dissatisfaction. It's chronic. So really it's the same as anger. It's almost attachment and anger have this intimate relationship. So attachment is this emotional hunger, believing I'll get happy when I get Eddie. And then aversion, disappointment and distress, a slap in the face when he doesn't fulfill my needs because I'm seeing him as more his than he really is. So always this two happening together all the time, wanting something and not getting it, wanting and not getting it. That's attachment and aversion. Attachment and aversion, they're practically the same in a way. Are you hearing everything? And it's totally primordially in the bones of our being, but only because we've practiced it. So we can unpractice it. And that's where the multitude of methods have to come to start. We went all through this today. Well, yes, it wasn't last time. There's just many attitudes and methods we have to use to counteract this primordial assumption that we believe is the absolute truth. You recognize?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So one of the approaches, because it's so ancient, we have to have this incredible humility with ourselves and patience to know it takes time because we can change it. But we want it. That's the irony. Attachment wants to get the result now. So we're dissatisfied with it. When we're dissatisfied with our efforts. This is the thing. No matter what we achieve, it's never enough. So it's always used the example, you know, you want to study music, you want to start it. And you get to grade one, you pass grade one. And then you go, oh, I'm only in grade one. Not satisfied. Then you do grade two, and the same. You get to grade 9,647. I'm only in grade 9,647. You're kind of communicating with me. Oh, depressing, really. So what's the trick? Start being happy. Start being satisfied. You've got to faithfully make it. Oh, I passed grade one, Mummy. You're so incredible, Rabina. I'm so happy for you, precious girl. Little Bobsy, you passed grade one. Wow, have a party. And then you've got enthusiasm to learn more and you've got your grade two. You feel the same. So you start to become this ridiculously joyful, happy, satisfied person. But satisfied for us means you're content. Then you sit back and go, oh, well, there's enough grade one. No, you get more enthusiasm to go more, learn more, grow deeper. But enthusiasm and delight in your progress is an absolutely fundamental step, and most of us can't do it. I can say these words, but I'm telling you, I'm like everybody else, you fall into the trap and I'm not enough, I didn't do enough, and I'm no good, and we panic attack. It's really subtle, really primordial, very deep and so tricky in there. With me?
Yeah, and I think that enthusiasm coming from the enthusiasm coming from, instead of coming from a dissatisfaction of how far you've got, coming from a
joy to do more, to learn more, to go deeper, the way to go. And that's why, if let's say, same with another analogy, a better one is you're on a journey, and maybe it's 1,000 kilometers. The goal is to get to wherever it is at 1,000 kilometers. I say it's probably more than that. Okay? Mm-hmm. So it's like In other words, you're trying to be dry. This isn't how we are. We're very distressed. You're faster and faster. You're never satisfied. I've got to get to Cairns. I've got to get to Cairns. Every second of the way, you're in torture. I'm not in the Cairns. Get away, Cairns. When I get to Cairns, you're still miserable. Thinking, oh, this happens when I get to Cairns. No, you won't. You've got to be happy now. Enjoy the first kilometre. Relax, have a cup of tea. Look at this wonderful. I'm so happy enjoying the journey. I'm not kidding. You all know these words. You're still looking forward to getting to Cairns. That's the goal. This is huge practice. But because these assumptions are these conceptions are at the level of assumption, we don't even notice that they're thoughts. And this is a tricky bit. We just think it's true. What we feel is true. So we don't counteract it. Who? Hello, Francesca. Talk to me, sweetheart.
Morning, Venerable. Can you hear me okay? Now, I'm just interested, I've been reading a bit about self-compassion. There seems to be a new movement towards nourishing ourselves, and this is in the psychological fields, you know, of how to feel happier with your life and things. So there's a lot of work being done with self-compassion, or having fierce self-compassion, you know, and being your own best friend. And I was just wondering, I sort of hear that just sort of saying you can't have compassion for others unless you care for yourself, you know, and whatever. So does that sort of contradict the teachings, or is there something that fits within the teachings of, you know, developing this thought for yourself and the strength within yourself so you can be there for everybody else?
Okay.
If you're wanting to be a bodhisattva.
I understand.
You know,
I find this interesting, isn't it? So when we say, you know, you can't take care of others if you don't take care of yourself. So if you're in the caring professions and you get exhausted, you know, burn out, all these things, which is reasonable, we understand. We don't, we'll go into it. Then we think we've got to take care of ourselves, go home, have a bath, have a relax, have a massage, right? And that's wonderful. We need that. But that's what, but the taking care of ourselves in Buddhism, initially we can't hear it as taking care of ourselves. It sounds brutal. So the way you take care of yourself is by giving up attachment, giving up anger, giving up jealousy, because this is the part now, let's discuss this one in depth, Francesca, and this is the hardest one for us to see. And it's not the analysis we use in modern psychology. This is unique to the Buddha. So it implies this fundamental view in Buddhist psychology where you've got these three categories of states of mind, millions of thoughts and feelings and emotions. This is clear. And millisecond by millisecond, there are all these thoughts playing out. And many of them manifest at an emotional level because they're very deeply ingrained. And that means when the physical body is involved, they're the ones we live in, the ups and downs of our emotions. But they're all rooted in being these conceptual thoughts down in the bones of our being. So millions of thoughts and experiences. So now those three, they can be divided into three categories. There's no fourth category. There are those, as I've just been saying, that are the neurotic ones, the deluded, disturbing, distressing, unhappy. Well, Yeshi, in his book on Mahamudra, he uses about 21 different terms that he uses in his yearning to get us to understand the workings of these neurotic states of mind. These are the root delusion, the one that assumes a separate, individual, neurotic, concrete self, me. Deep in our bones, so hard to recognize. On the basis of that is this one called attachment, which is hard enough to recognize. And because of practicing over-exaggerating with deliciousness of something, because of being dissatisfied, because of practicing over-exaggerating something, we keep falling into a trap. We think this is worth $500. We think it is more than it really is. And what's coming is this massive vampirish expectation that he better make me happy, that 500 better give me 500's worth, and then you're devastated when he doesn't do the thing right. See, you're devastated when the 500 doesn't come, it's only $50 worth. So we keep repeating, building it up more and more. More dissatisfaction, more disappointment. More dissatisfaction, more disappointment. So when we hear the Buddha's view, this is a neurotic one. First one, attachment. Then on the basis of it not getting what you want, aversion arises, disappointment, irritation, upset, frustrated, and then when it builds up, it becomes depression. These are the two main ones, attachment, aversion. Yeah. Are we communicating so far, Francesca? These, attachment and aversion, and then the other whole branch for those, pride, arrogance, jealousy, these ones. Okay, we know them all, pain talking. So, okay, now you go to help people. You want to help people. The next category is the positive ones. Love, compassion, empathy, generosity, forgiveness, patience, all these ones. We know these. These are the second category of thoughts and things in our mind. But all mixed together with the first lot, almost indistinguishable, because we've never learned to see the difference. They all come together like in a big soup. And the third lot, and we forget this here, but I call these the mechanics of the mind, the parts that enable us to function, concentration, good memory, being able to discriminate between this and that. Whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need those. So we'll leave these out of it. So these first two categories, these are the parts that dominate our lives. So the Buddha's view is, there I'm having compassion. I see someone suffering. Compassion is this marvelous sense of a connectedness with others. It's not based on the neurotic eye. It's based on a sense of connectedness. Your heart reaches out. That's compassion. Now, the key thing in Buddhist psychology is this. You cannot possibly suffer from virtues. You can't possibly. They're not the cause of suffering. It's impossible for the virtuous state of mind and the virtuous action to cause you suffering. No way. That's not the way we think in our culture. So what happens is we see someone suffering and then we have compassion and then we're freaking out. So we suffer, we get depressed, we go home, we can't stand it. We even kill ourselves because we can't stand seeing the suffering. So let's analyze that. The Buddhist analysis is this. The root of my problems is this constant dissatisfaction, constant emotional hunger, constant attachment, which causes constant manipulation and controlling and expectation and to make things the way that I want so I can be happy. It's quite frantic. It's quite really junky in there, quite desperate. It's there all the time. But it's mitigated by the compassion. If you only had attachment and anger and jealousy, you'd be what's called a sociopath, all these fancy words. You'd be narcissistic. You'd be psychotic even if you can't access any virtues. So we can access our virtues. They're our saving grace. And they calm down the neuroses. But we don't see this. So what happens is this. You see the suffering. Compassion arises. But at the same time, your attachment's having a panic attack. It only wants nice things. Attachment can't stand anything that isn't nice. It has a panic attack, and that panic attack is called aversion. Are we communicating here? That's why you suffer and get burned out and exhausted from helping others. Because attachment wants everything to be lovely. It can only handle things being nice. Are we, can you sort of hear that point? So the second you see suffering, your compassion is there, but it gets crashed upon, polluted, dragged down by the panic of attachment and aversion that we don't even label as that. So we assume we suffer because people are suffering. No, you suffer because you have attachment and aversion. So far, so good, Francesca. Can you hear that analysis? Now, the next step is, how do I have self-compassion? By working on my own delusions. But we think that's blame. We think it's blaming me. No, you work on your delusions. So in other words, you know, you work on your delusions, you become less attached and less angry. Now, if it's overwhelming for you because your attachment is so strong, you keep away from those sick people because you can't handle it. So that's one way of taking care of yourself. It's too much for you to go to that hospital where everyone's dying and you have no way to help. So you keep away from it, you protect yourself. And then you work on your own mind. You lessen attachment, lessen aversion, and you become more courageous. And then when you see the suffering, because you know, and then you know karma, it's not what I've kept the fish, you have an explanation for why there is all this suffering. It doesn't drag you down. And then you become like the bodhisattva, who more suffering, the better for them. It's grist for their mill. They get courage and enthusiasm. They have an explanation. They know why it's happening. And because they've done the wisdom wing, they're taking care of themselves every second. They don't even need to sleep. They've got enthusiasm. So the reason we suffer in the face of suffering isn't the suffering of others. It's because attachment can't stand it, and then we have aversion, which becomes depression, or it turns into blame. And who am I going to blame, you know, for all the suffering? We just get full of anger. Are we communicating or not? So taking care of yourself does mean keeping distant from the problem. It does mean having a massage and a sleep and a weep and a little bex and a lie down, or whatever we used to do. But it also really means learning to know your own mind, take responsibility, not with guilt, but with kindness, realizing, look at my suffering, look at how fragile I am, look at how up and down I am. I've got to work on my mind. This is the part that's hard because we hear it as blame. Do you understand? This is the Buddhist analysis, but it's hard because it's not how we think in our culture. A completely different analysis, isn't it? That's a tough one.
Can I just ask another question here? So, you know, we're trying to sort of develop this state of mind in an environment which really isn't very conducive for us to develop this state of mind. And so how do we manage? How do we fend off the external and focus on the internal when we're so
absorbed? If you can remove yourself from it, if you can, because you can't cope, then marvellous. But much of the time we can't escape it. So all we can do is kind of like my friends in prison who don't have the luxury of removing themselves from these garbage dumps, they are forced to jump in the deep end of practice and do this job for their own sanity. You hear me or not?
It's very hard to avoid, you know, all that sort of negativity around you without absorbing some of it, you know, no, without the armor.
Because we have attachment. Because when you hear other people being critical and you see about bombs and wars and your attachment can't, you know, is very fragile and wants it all only to be lovely news, then aversion arises and then it sticks its nose in and starts finding fault. How dare these people? Look at that war. Who are these people harming each other? Because aversion is anger, which is finding fault. So then we blame the outside and then it drags us down to hell. So of course it's difficult. We've got to watch our minds and walk every second.
Yes. So in the context of the four immeasurables, where does this sort of
this is not discussion, darling. This is the compassion wing.
Yeah.
This is the compassion wing. These thoughts are on the thoughts of a person who's done this job.
Right.
That's my point. This is the wisdom wing. This is the nuts and bolts of Buddhist practice of karma and the mind. This has got nothing to do with compassion. So the compassion one, so in other words, this is junior school and high school, the wisdom wing. The compassion is university. You can't leap into university. So I'm giving you junior school and high school so that you can do university, which is compassion.
Right. Just running a bit ahead of myself, I suppose.
But you're not running ahead of yourself. Yeah. You're asking a perfect question.
That's why I
can't just, you know, I mean, the teachers, when you listen to the Lama's teaching, the way they teach you, you go to a class that's called the Teaching on Compassion. They will give you exactly the teaching on compassion, but it's too hard to hear it. So I just have to keep going back to the first one. Because we can't hear them. Are you hearing what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And I've taken notes. Thanks. Thank you so much.
Okay, questions? Yes, we know.
If we get rid of the delusions, the ignorance, the attachment, all the negative states, you know, the sort of... self-labeled, I'm a good person. You know, when you think to yourself, oh, I'm a good person, I'm virtuous, I'm this, I'm that.
Well, that's two different things there. So the first point is get rid of the delusion, and then you said that one. So that's
three. Well, to me, that's part of the delusion.
Oh, no, but that's a different discussion. That's one of them. So the second to the first one. All right. We need to get rid of delusions then.
Yeah. What's that?
That's Nirvana, baby.
Yeah. Okay.
So now I'll tell you how you'll be. Shall I tell you how you'll be? Shall I tell you how it will be?
Yes.
You'll achieve Karmavati, which just itself is this which ingenious psychological school that genius India invented 3,000 years ago that enables you to access the subtle level of your mind at a conventional level, and your mind is radiant and clear and crystal clear. You can see all your thoughts, you know exactly what's going on, you can work on it, you get rid of your delusions, you'd be insanely joyful all the time. That's the bonus. And then other one, you'd only have virtues left because they're your natural state. You can't get rid of them. So you'd only be joyful. You'd be unneurotic. You'd have incredible clairvoyance as a bonus. You see the minds of others, the future, the past. You'll have incredible love, passion, kindness, generosity, and you'd be joyful and stable and blissful. That's what the meaning of nirvana is. So you can finish there if you want to and zap into bliss because you won't have to come back if you cut the root of suffering. But if you're on the you're not finished yet, you now have to add compassion to the mix, where you now activate compassion and love a billion times more strongly, and then you become a Buddha.
Okay. What's the question? So I won't just thought come up and disappear.
You would if you didn't have the bodhisattva path. Yeah, you'd zap into month after year after year, life after life, your goal is let me get the hell out of samsara. That's renunciation. You need that. This is discovering, I'm sick of all the suffering. And Buddha's telling, I'll say more in a minute. So then that's your goal. So as you progress along life after life and you start to get rid of, you start to control your body and speech, you get your vows, you purify, you go to the next level, you start to understand your mind, you get rid of attachment and anger, then you get to the root of it, then you get shamatha, then you realize you cut the root of illusion, you realize emptiness at some life or other, you now quit the lot, no causes to get reborn, you're out of here, baby. And what happens then, you've already got masses of love and compassion. That's all that's left. But at the time you die, because your goal has been let me get out of samsara, your bliss and your overrides your compassion and you zap into bliss and don't come back. But if you're on the bodhisattva path, your goal is Buddhahood. You might even achieve that level of you don't need to come back, but you want to come back because your compassion overrides your bliss. Did you hear all that a lot?
I think so.
Well, I said it a bit pretty huge, I thought. No. I sort of got to get it out before it gets. I've got like a book in my head. I've got to get it out. I know. What am I saying? So ask your question again.
If I get rid of all the
delusions,
you know.
Yeah, delusions. Yeah.
But then is there anything left of me?
Yes, your mind is existing.
Yeah.
Your mind exists and all the virtues are there. You know about love and compassion. You heard about them?
Yeah.
They haven't gone, honey.
Yeah.
Your mind is fully suffused with them now. So you're insanely joyful, insanely wise, insanely compassionate, but your bliss is even more radiant. And then, of course, your goal has been to get out of samsara life after life. And when you die, you won't come back. But you're
just so I'm getting rid of what I am not.
Precisely. And what they often don't say it like that. We forget. We sort of think we get rid of all delusions and there's nothing left. No, there's masses left. Your love, compassion, wisdom, joy, bliss. But that's not enough for you because you've been training your mind to get access up. And then when the day you die, whatever life you die, once you've achieved this nirvana, then your bliss, which is incredible, overrides any compassion you had and you don't come back. But if you're on the bodhisattva path, even though you've got rid of all the rubbish, you keep going. You want to help others, baby. We're on the same boat.
Yeah.
How can you dare not? How can you dare go into this?
Yes, by myself, yeah.
On your own? No, you don't. They say, Geshe-Tashi apparently said, Geshe-Tashi in here, he said, if you stay in this nirvana for a few eons, you're in a certain subtle state of peace. Buddha comes along one day and taps you on the shoulder. Oh, he didn't say this, but I'm telling you what he said. Come on, honey, now stop just being your own trip. Come back onto the bodhisattva path. Come back and be a human. Giving up the bliss of that nirvana is the worst suffering of the universe. I remember him saying that.
Yeah.
It's interesting. See, this idea of bliss sounds hilarious to us. I have to read you from Lama Yeshe, his Maha Buddha book. Lama would always try to excite us. They never talk about the experiences you have if you get certain realizations, but Lama would point them out. So in this book, Maha Buddha, which is How to Realize Emptiness, he describes some of the qualities you'd have if you just had single point of concentration. It sounds like science fiction for us. It sounds demented. There's no such thing in our science and psychology. It's insane. And there are methods of how to get it. It's been around 3,000 years. Don't stand. So I'll read you back from that later, after a month or something. So another way to put this, let me discuss this one now. This is what it is. Anyway, more questions, please. Come on. What's your name? Who are you?
Karen.
What's your name?
Karen.
She looks to sound doubtful. She wasn't sure if I was talking to that old thing or another one. All this is Buddhist psychology, people. Don't call it religion. It's psychology, it's your mind. Yeah.
This sounds like it. I've heard you say before that our love and attachment is mixed together. Based on that premise, is it a pipe dream of trying to reduce our attachment while being in a romantic life?
I understand. I'm exactly your words. I understand. It's the hardest job you'll ever do, but you can always be optimistic. Put it that way. It is the hardest job you'll ever do because, first of all, we think love and attachment are literally the same. We can't tell the difference. So then, you know, so then it's enormously difficult. It's like, it's really a bit like this. If you're an alcoholic, you know it would be impossible to give up, hear my words, attachment to alcohol while continuing to drink alcohol. We know that you've got to get rid of the, you've got to remove yourself from the object first. So that's why people kill each other in relationships, not because they love each other, but because attachment doesn't get what it wants, then the anger arises, and then the craziness, and then the fights and the dramas, and we see two dead people. We wonder why, you know. So it is the hardest job we'll ever do, but if you've got a lot of virtue, a lot of goodness, and got good karmic connection with that person, then it will work very well. Some people actually, it works very well. But often the trick is, the trap is, that mainly you're just fulfilling each other's attachments, needs, and you're calling it happiness, but it's very short term, and it's not that virtuous, really. So you've got to really distinguish the virtuous part, which is being patient and loving and kind and generous and forgiving. And the real sign that it's not attachment, more than love, is that you can happily be apart and not have a mental breakdown. Some people, when it's attachment, you're like cloned together and you can't ever be separate. That's neurotic, with respect. Are you hearing me? You hearing me?
I definitely am, yeah.
Okay. So that means you have to see the difference. So if it's attachment, it makes you feel nervous, distressed, anxious, needy, neurotic, possessive, controlling. If it's love, you're more spacious, you're more peaceful, you're more easygoing. So they're two good signs to know which is which. Okay?
Then Ravina, I've got this conflict going on where I have friends who I want what's best for them, but on occasion they will ask things that I can't do when they're going through like marriage crisis, things like asking me to write to Oprah and Ellen for money, which, you know, I really, really, this poor ass. But every time we meet, it's all about money. It's all about wills. It's all about, and I grieve for her. I'm not very upset for her.
She's a good friend.
She's lost her grandparents who were like parents to her. However, I can't take on board. I'm trying to be a bodhisattva. I'm really trying, Venerable. I can't take on board any more about her family drama without, I don't know how to distance myself but still being a good friend. I'm not being bombarded constantly because it's all about, I'm fine, it's all about her. I have shared my own problems with her in the past when I was going through great suffering. I received nothing. At the time, I thought, this isn't fair. I understand it now. It's fine with my karma. I understand that I have to work on my own mind, which I did.
My question to you is, why are you continuing to hang out with this person? That's my question. That's the one question I have.
And in my mind, I know it's attachment. Because the friendship is such a long friendship.
No, wait a minute. Wait a minute. It's attachment to what? Attachment to it. Okay. If the sun keeps burning you have to go inside.
Mm-hmm.
So the sun's burning you right here.
Yes.
Don't blame the woman. You see her mind exactly. So you've got to simply, don't say, oh, I know it's attachment. It's too broad.
Okay.
Why? So you have to look at why you want to continue to be hanging out with this person. As a given, given that you discover it, let's smear it.
It's all right not to continue being around.
Have you not heard what I just said down there about alcohol?
Yes, I did. And that's why.
Why you so confused?
I've been holding on to this question for 3 years. I wanted to ask you. So come on.
Listen to me, darling. Listen to me.
Yes.
So you're trying to work out the compassion one, but you're not qualified yet.
No.
So in other words, if you had the wisdom, you had the wisdom, you've got some realizations, you've given up your attachment, then you could handle it as a microseparatist. It wouldn't even be a blink in the eye, but you'd agonize because you're trying hard to be a good sufferer, but you haven't got enough wisdom to know that you should just leave this damn person alone. I mean, have compassion.
So it's okay to mind my own business?
Well, excuse me, why are you surprised at that?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you thinking that's not a good idea? Tell me why you think that's not good.
I want her to be happy.
No, what's that got to do with the price of fish?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm asking you seriously, think about why you think you have to hang around pythons and snakes and lions and harmful people.
I go deeply, it's pleasing others.
That's right, dear. It's attached to reputation. It's you being attached to being a good girl.
Exactly.
Well, then don't have to say exactly, don't rush in and agree with me. See it and, you know, and be, oh my God, that's what it is. I'd better start working on this.
Because I don't care actually what other people
do. No, you do. Desperate. You do. I'm sorry, we all do. It's the last attachment to go. It's the most, so subtle, we don't even notice it. It's the last attachment to go. The fact of attachment is that we have this separate sense of self, and attachment is this lack inside ourselves and that we always hunger for something. So you mightn't hunger for money or pleasure, but you're hungering for approval, to be a good girl, this vision. And you're like the rest of us, I'm not being personal.
No.
And just think that you think it's sensible to keep trying to pat the lion on the head, and you wonder why it bites your hand. I've got to be a bodhisattva, I'm trying to pat the lion. Give it a break, mate.
No, that is, makes complete sense. Thank you so much, Bernal Rubino. I appreciate everything.
Sorry, thank you. Love her for who she is.
Thank you so much.
Love her for who she is with me, wanted to be happy. And then, you know, if there's an opportunity to do it, then fine. Instead of sucking your energy dry, having to bite your hand every time, it's just idiocy.
Venerable, can I just add one thing I have to say is you and Mama Yeshe saved me.
No, you saved me. Just our words tribute.
Well, we'll teach you. I'm going to say the
word. Mama Yeshe has tribute your wisdom. Well done.
My life. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm Lama's daughter. I'm just saying Lama's words is my own mouth. Good I am. This is the talk about being kind to ourselves. This is a huge one. So this does get us to understand the attack and the reputation. It's one that's like when I first heard it, I thought these people are stupid. I don't know what people think about me. We all say that. I mean, everybody says that. We have no idea what we said. It's the subtlest attachment. It's the one that's the last to go. The yogis in the mountains, they say, have given up everything, sex, drugs, rock and roll. They're amazing. They've probably even got shamatha. But they're still thinking of what the people in the village down the bottom of the mountain are thinking about them. This voice is in continuously in our mind. We're always having conversations. We're seeing someone seeing us do something. We're imagining someone saying something and we do something. And that's where if we do naughty things, we try to hide it. This is just the nature of ego grasping and the nature of this deepest attachment, which is the main voice of ego grasping. So really to have that gone is you practically realize emptiness, but that's gone. You with me? You can't come upstairs and have a cup of tea and bring your sandwich.
That's
good. So if you're going to be together, try and make this 2 hours part of the weekend, which means there are two options. Talk about this or zip the lid. Okay?